Good evening, everyone. It's good to see a number of faces that I saw last night and to see a few new faces. It's good to welcome you here. I'm Richard Burnham. I direct Adult Education Ministries here at the church. And we're excited to see this turnout as we've come together for a topic that is relevant and timely. We're especially excited to have Dr. Abraham here with us. Lee will share a few words about him in just a moment, but I would like to take just a moment of personal privilege to say something about the lectureship itself. When Judy Matthews, for whom this lectureship is offered in memory of, when she came on to the staff at the church, it was well known and well recognized that she had a special gift for working with children. She had a great love for children, a connection to children, and so that was seen as a wonderful blessing to the church. One of the first things that she said to me as I was the pastor of the church at that time was that she felt a special call to develop the adult education ministries of the church. For one reason, she felt that she felt that if you could reach the adults, they're going to bring the children to church, and you could therefore reach the children through the adults. But also, she just felt like that the process of growth and development as disciples was a vital part of who we are as a church. So she then decided to develop her own skills and abilities by going through the program for certification as a Christian educator. She would go every year. I think the month was May. Lee could speak to that better. He had to cook during the month of May for 2 weeks. And she did that for 5 years to work on her certification. In the process of that, she began to see what a rich joy and benefit it was to be with people who are learned in the fields of biblical scholarship, of theology, things like practical theology, education, and so on. And so she began to strive toward bringing people that she came to know and respect and appreciate to this church. So out of that spirit then, this lectureship emerged and evolved, and it's a way for us to not only honor Judy, but also carry forth the ministry that she established and gave her heart and spirit to. So I value this night so much and value your presence, and pray that out of the sharing that we have, you'll go forth enriched. Lee, you want to share a word about Dr. Abraham?
First of all, I'd like to thank the Open Hearts class for the soup supper that we had tonight. Give them a big hand. Thank y'all very much. The Sunday school class is here, doing an awful lot. Was anyone not here last night? Okay, just one or two? Okay. I can't remember everything I said last night. But we're glad to welcome Dr. William Abraham to be our speaker again on terrorism in theology. Very interesting and very timely subject for all of us. And as I said last night, Dr. Abraham is the Albert Cook Outler Professor of Wessler Studies at Perkins, where he teaches, and has also been appointed the Schuller University Distinguished Teacher, also at SMU. So he won a lot of honors, and I think, as you saw last night, he's a very, very intriguing speaker, and especially on such a hard topic, a challenging topic, as what we had to help us understand it and to go forth with it. You know, like I said last night, Dr. Abraham has written many books, many articles, and in talking to him, you know, he's continuing and he's always working and writing all the time. So I think you'll be hearing more. So I'd like to welcome again Dr. Abraham for this session, and thank you very much.
Well, it's a great pleasure. Am I on? Do I need to push a button or anything? Okay, lovely. It's a great pleasure to be here. You know, for those of you who are Methodists, that it was the Irish that brought Methodism to America. It was not the English. They came over and wrecked it later on. And so I've just come over to say thank you for all that you've done for the rest of the world. In fact, you helped save Irish Methodism in the middle of the 19th century, believe it or not. And this is the place to be. So tomorrow I will leave and go back up to the high living and low thinking up in Dallas. It's been a great pleasure being with you. Now, I didn't announce what I was going to do tonight, last night, which is even more amazing to see you back. I think my central thesis last night was that there was an intimate connection between terrorism as practiced in Al-Qaeda and in ISIS and theology. In other words, I think that you can't simply dismiss it in terms of political goals or class or economic conditions and so on. There are many, many reasons why a terrorist group will exist. But it becomes really interesting when you find out that some of the reasons why they engage in what they do is in fact theological. And this is in contrast to the Irish situation, where I think it's driven fundamentally by nationalism and is therefore driven by a form of idolatry. Now, terrorism, as I understand it, is the use of terror against innocent civilians in order to achieve political purposes. Now, there are various groups that will engage in terrorism which don't have necessarily political aims. So, for example, you can have mafia terrorism. Groups of criminals can operate using terrorism as strategy. But what makes this kind of terrorism both difficult and confusing is precisely because it's motivated and grounded in a very particular version of radical Islam. Now, this is not a popular thing for people in my profession to say. But I think it's the truth of the matter, and it in no way says that all of Islam is terrorist, or that we're against Islam, or whatever. I know last time, in fact, that there is mainstream Islam, which has been vociferous in its rejection of the use of terrorism. It's not gotten the press I think it should get. And there is an extremely important network of reformers within Islam in Europe and in the United States. And I ended with the good news, I think, at the end. You can tell I'm a fan of the United States with all its interesting sort of ballyhoo at times. You're very noisy people. But I think, in fact, that the kind of culture that you've created over here effectively house trains everybody who shows up. And I deliberately use that rather graphic analogy. That's to say, you take whoever comes, and because of the strength of your political and civic culture, you inculcate over time a spirit of tolerance and a spirit of civil generosity, which I think is extraordinarily important. Now, if you want me to lecture on that, I'll come back at another occasion and talk to you about civil religion, or if you want me to talk about Methodism, I'll do that too. You tell me to talk about anything, I'll talk about it. That's what's going to happen. Now, terrorism raises a whole series of issues. It poses very fundamental questions as to what kind of culture we want to have. It poses very fundamental questions about how we relate politics and religion. You have a unique way of doing that. It poses questions for ordinary citizens. What can the ordinary Josephine do when terrorism sort of breaks loose in your community. There's also very difficult and interesting questions about what about the victims? How do they handle issues of forgiveness and grief and reconciliation? It's a major issue in the north of Ireland. But I want to take another angle on it tonight, and I want to deal with what does the existence of terrorists tell us about the nature of evil and about the nature of human beings? Now, I'm a theologian, so I make no apology for dealing with this. The job of the theologian is to talk about God and to talk about things like evil and sin and how things are put right. And at the end of the day, I think a theological analysis means we've got to come to terms with, in fact, the existence of heinous evil in our midst. I take it to be the case that terrorism is intrinsically evil. That's to say, to train people, indoctrinate people, to use terror against innocent civilians for political purposes, I just think that is intrinsically evil. And the way in which, say, something like rape is intrinsically evil. You don't need a book to tell you that. It's given to us actually in General Revelation and Conscience. But terrorism raises a sort of a much set of deeper questions as to how do we think about evil in more general terms. Now, I think initially what we've got to be very clear about is that terrorist acts are genuinely free acts brought about by human agents, and they are not acts of God. God can no more bring it about that people freely choose not to commit terrorist acts than they can make round squares or creatures that walk without feet. Those of you who are sort of into consistency, then let you work that out. In other words, I'm a radical freedom person. I hate Calvinism with a perfect hatred. Can I say that here? Are there any Calvinists in our midst? Right. That's how I say, I think actually one of the most important elements in Methodism in the 19th century, theologically, was its championing of the freedom of human agents. This was developed particularly in Boston, of all places. And I think it's one of the great legacies of Methodism and of Wesley, whether you do it through prevenient grace or not. I think God creates agents who are genuinely free. And God treats us as adults. And real freedom means that we don't live in some kind of toy world. God does not treat us as adolescents. And in that respect, in certain respects, the problem of evil for me is not the standard one which shows up in academic texts. The problem with freedom of evil with me is why sometimes God does just not step in and dispose of certain people. I have a long list of people. You'd be glad to know nobody in this room is included on it. And it wouldn't take very much to sort of eliminate them. My favorite would be sleep apnea. So it could die in their bed with a heart attack or something in the middle of the night. By the way, I myself have sleep apnea, so that's why I picked that one. But often people worry about the problem of evil, and atheists, and come back to this in a minute. The problem of evil for me, in fact, is a theological problem as to why God gives us so much freedom. And I think the deep argument in play at that stage is that we do not live in a toy world. We can make real decisions. So it's not just a matter of whether I'll fly with United or with Lufthansa or whatever. We can make decisions about, are we going to study the future of the universe? Are we going to spend our money on that rather than something else? And when we find out about the future of the universe, what are we going to do with that information? So it's not a matter of will I have tea this morning or will I have coffee. God actually has brought us into a drama of creation and freedom in which we're given incredible responsibility. And it means responsibility for other people, and it means also that we can do enormous harm, both to creation and to people whom God has made. Now, atheists who focus in on the problem of evil set all this aside. They simply abandon belief in God and leave horrendous evil in place. And this, of course, is a neat way out. I'm beginning to study the book of Job, which actually I don't really think it's about the problem of evil. I think it's about the problem of tenacity. Will you stay the course when you get run over by a bus and everything falls apart? It's a bit like Abraham of old, who can't see at all why he would do what God asked him to do. And the question was, would he stay the course? It's a problem of tenacity. And that's another issue. In the short term, in my own experience, I'm going to take some time in my own journey at this point, I abandoned belief in God when I was a teenager. As I mentioned last night, I was brought up in the bosom of the church, but its message and its practices never made much sense to me. I would try out faith in a serious way under the influence of a wonderful primary teacher called Miss Abbott. And it was one of those children's meetings where you were asked to sort of give your life to Jesus. It was a pretty good meeting, actually. Good music, message was clear. I thought, okay, I'll give this a try. And I got home, and remember now, I'm from a family of six boys. My father was killed in an accident when we were small. And my mother took us to a small farm, and it was my turn to go out and put in the chickens. The chickens had to be put in to roost for the night. And I lost my religion there and then, because I said, I'm not putting any chickens in it. Ken puts the chickens in. It's my brother's turn. I'm not doing any chickens. And I was sent to school when I was 3 and a half because I threatened a babysitter with my hobnail boots. They said we've got to do something with this character before he wrecks the place. I still remember the first day I went to school. At the age of 11, I got into what's called a local grammar school, a place called Portora Royal School, which was built in the 1660s. And I got stuck into the joys of studying. So if there are any young people out there, let me tell you something. At the age of 11, I was told this. A pen is easier to carry than a shovel. And you don't have to like the teacher. So, while I was there, I underwent a secret intellectual awakening. I remember going to the many funerals that were common in the beautiful countryside of Fermanagh, where I was brought up, and listening to ministers talking about the resurrection of the dead. And I thought, that made no sense whatsoever. Human beings are some fundamentally complicated configurations of physics and chemistry. We return to dust, and that's the end of it. Now, for a while, I had a lingering fear of hell. But then I worked this out. It dawned on me, if there's no God, there's no hell. Whoops, I'm free. What are you worried about? And it was like, oh, sort of the whole thing rolled off my shoulders. Now, what happened was that I then had to figure out what kind of atheist I was going to be. Come back to this shortly. I have actually a very interesting lecture. It sounds a bit pompous. It's a lecture on how to cheat as an atheist, how to intellectually cheat as an atheist. But I decided to think about it for 3 months. John Wesley's mother used to say he wouldn't go to the toilet if he didn't have a reason. I was a bit like that in my younger days. And when I began to think about issues, the issue of evil became very interesting to me. Because if you believe in purely material universe, it's going to be very hard to talk about acts, about human acts, to begin with, because you're just a configuration of physics and chemistry, run by the laws of physics and chemistry. probably worth about $7 in terms of the actual body parts, but melted them all down. So there's no room really for human persons in a world which is purely material. And as I say, if our actions are purely determined, if all that we do is purely determined, then in fact to talk about evil doesn't make much sense. However, the problem of evil cut deeper for me than that. I sensed that to leave evil as a purely human phenomenon was entirely superficial. I thought to myself, you know, one of the great things about being brought up in Ireland is you have no illusions about people. There's too much sin around. As my mother would say, Billy, it's just people. So I began to ruminate on, now this is a really tricky part for those of you who are, you know, very highbrow, so listen carefully. I began to think about, well, there's a lot of evil around, including the evil in my own heart. Is it possible that the demonic exists? Watch out what your children are thinking of, and your grandchildren. Now, I remember vividly walking along the Sligo Road, in Enniskillen, outside the Salvation Army Hall. And I said, I've just thought it's possible for the devil to exist. I believe in the devil, but it's possible the devil exists. Which means it's possible there's more to reality than material reality. And at that minute, I knew I was in deep trouble. Because if that's possible, God is possible. And if God is possible, I'm back trying to figure out what I'm going to do. I thought I had that settled. Now here, I'm actually grateful for my Irish background. We believe in the little people. Superstition can be a really useful cognitive sort of background music. One story on the side, my uncle George, farmer. Back there was a lonely tree in the middle of a field. He would never cut it down. Why? Your sow might become infertile. Because the little people would come after you. In Sligo, about 30 years ago, there was a set of government workers who were supposed to build a road through a field. And in the middle of the field was a lonely tree where fairies live. They couldn't get a single man in that squad to cut that tree down. And they had to go around. They had to go all around it. I don't know how much it cost. Now, I'm being very subtle here. Be careful. All that was going on was suddenly my materialism, if I can call it that, was sort of like undermined because the possibility of an unseen world opened up. Not that I believed in it. So once that opened up, then I was a very, very vulnerable unbeliever. Now what happened was I was still going to church. Now I sort of could put on a relatively good show and not look out of place. So when it came to the sermon, I used to get out the hymn book and pretend I was reading it. I was listening to every single word. And then I'll just give you the sort of like the core elements of stage. Suddenly find myself believing in God. But that wasn't what really got me. What got me was the incarnation. The invisible has become visible in Christ. Now, I don't know whether you sing well down here in this church, but if you've got a bunch of Irish peasants singing Charles Wesley's hymns with four-part harmony, it's pretty powerful stuff. He laid his glory by, he wrapped him in our clay, unmarked by human eye, the latent Godhead lay. Infant of days, he here became and bore the mild Emmanuel's name. This was really difficult. I bought myself a copy of the New Testament by J.B. Phillips. Some of you remember that. Now, in my house, you weren't supposed to become religious. So I read this at 1 o'clock in the morning when everybody else was in bed. And any of you who've read great German theologian Karl Barth, Barth describes how when he started rereading his New Testament and his Bible, he said it was like sitting in a room looking out the window. And there were all those people out there looking up. And he knew they were looking at something, but he wasn't quite sure what it was. And it was that way with me. I knew these people were onto something. I knew there was something extraordinarily important happening in Jesus. The invisible had become visible. And then the next issue was, what do I do with this? And then all hell broke loose because I had a call into the ministry. Now, for me, there were three genders. There was male, and there was female, and there was ministers. You know, ministers didn't need to go to the toilet. And ministers didn't need to clean up their rooms. This was an enormous problem. I had no models to go on. I was getting an exceptionally good education. And so all my brothers were sort of, when they got wind that things were moving, said, what's gotten into him? I mean, he's the one that can go off and make a fortune. And here he is. The rumor is he's thinking about becoming a Methodist preacher. And after I made my commitment, my mother looked at me one day when I sort of came back from church and she said, Billy, I'll never forget this. She said, Billy, you haven't become religious, have you? Boy, that cut to the heart. I'm very pleased to say that at the end of her days, she came to faith. And by the way, in Irish Methodism, the sign of coming to faith is that you take communion. In Ireland, everybody bolts on communion Sunday. And they don't take communion. And that was the signal that she was giving that she'd come in. So anyway, I then continued to work my way through the my education in Portora and elsewhere. And coming to terms with the faith, I have an analogy for this. I've developed this in a book on divine revelation called Crossing the Threshold of Divine Revelation. I think becoming a Christian intellectually, there are various ways you can think about it. I think it's actually a bit like getting married. You don't know what you're getting into until you get on the inside. Or to use a more homely analogy before I get to my threshold one, it's like buying two English Cocker Spaniel dogs and then discovering that one of them's going to get pups. But here's my analogy. I think when you're coming to faith, as I was, and I sort of was extraordinarily helped by my local Methodist church, but at the end it's like stepping across a threshold and then having to deal with a whole new world. And the analogy I like to use, I was born in the bogs. I'm very proud of that. If I ever write my memoirs, it'll be a man from the bogs. My wife says, no, that's not appropriate, but we'll leave that aside. And where I was born, there was a mountain close by. And as youngsters, we used to take our bicycles. The great thing about this mountain was you could take your bicycles and you could go around the back. And because of the elevation, it only took you 20 minutes to reach the top. It was so easy. So when you would go around the back, you'd start going up the back end of the mountain. You see very little. Then you reach the top, and you had a 360-degree vision and perspective. Now, what happens among those who are unbelievers is that they look at terrorism with the eyes of unbelief. They're not inside what you might call the circle of faith and the circle of divine revelation. And I think too many atheists cheat at this point. Because it's not that you just become an atheist. You've got to figure out what kind of atheist you're going to be. Will you be a Marxist atheist? Or a Buddhist atheist? Or a Freudian atheist? Or maybe even a Nazi atheist? And the issue of their cheating is they think that all we've got to do is knock down arguments in favor of God. And the game is over. This whole new generation of aggressive atheists who've appeared, we've got our work cut out dealing with them. There's millions of dollars behind some of these enterprises. I have a student who's going to set me up with a billionaire who funds atheistic sort of projects. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask him for $1 million for our missionary work in Nepal to build a hospital and see what happens. I'm deadly serious. Now, I think in that respect, I think it's very important that Christians figure out we are not Muslim Christians. We respect Muslim Christians. They have a profound sense of the unity of God. Very important. Tremendous sense of the integrity of God, of the transcendence of God, of the awesome character of God. You know? And they have a deep belief in divine revelation, which I think is a very important feature of any serious theistic universe. But we are robust Christians. I am. I want to be a robust Christian, a Wesleyan Christian. And so in this respect, I think what I'm getting at here is that when you deal with the issue of evil, you can of course deal with it as if you're an outsider. And that's what a lot of atheists do, and then have very little to say in a moment. I'll come to that. But what I want to get to at the end tonight is that we have a set of resources to think about evil, which we need to, if you like, plunder afresh. Now, in this respect, there's a kind of intellectual poverty when it comes to dealing with evil. Good old-fashioned Marxists, for example, reduce evil to economics. That's the real problem in the world. Tracking its origins and forms to the abuse of economic resources. Scientific humanists look to biology or sociology for analysis and explanation. Romantic humanists, who are a different ballgame, have little but anarchic individualism to fall back on when they try and deal with evil. Freudian atheists say it may all come down to potty training. Now, many have tried again and again to trace any and all forms of evil to religion. That is, to superstition, ignorance, priestcraft, fear of the afterlife, credulous faith, and any other crumb that they can find in the region of this or that faith. And this has become something of a blood sport in 21st century. So the English may have banned fox hunting, but no one has banned faith hunting. And many atheists have been convinced that once we get rid of religion, we would have sunshine and light all around. The story of the modern world has been presented again and again as one of emancipation and enlightenment from religion. The history of ideas, indeed modern history generally, has been told as a story of liberation from faith. In reality, it has been a story of moving from faith to idolatry, where this or that brutal vision of the world has been foisted upon us in the name of progress and light. There are, in fact, extremely dangerous forms of atheism abroad in the world. But the alternative to a dangerous version of theism is not a peaceful version of atheism. It may well be a brutal version of atheism that operates without a conscience and without constraint. So the idea that atheism is a benign alternative is a sick joke to anyone who takes the history of the modern period seriously. It's high time, in my judgment, another lecture, that the high priests of contemporary atheism wised up about the mad ants that are buried in their basements. Now, whatever our ultimate vision of the world, we will have to come to terms with evil in our midst. And as one trained in philosophy, I'm delighted to say that more recent philosophy has begun to take evil with radical seriousness. The obvious question that comes to mind at this point is this. What light might faith throw upon the evil of terrorism? What might we say about terrorism if we look at it across the threshold of divine revelation inside what I like to call the canonical faith of the church? Now, it's no accident that Christian thinkers have worked valiantly to provide a deep reading of evil, and indeed of terrorism. One of the wittiest depictions of evil generally has come from the pen of a very famous lapsed Irishman. That is from C.S. Lewis, whom the English stole. They steal our soccer players, they steal our academics, and they even steal the few theologians we've got. In his brilliant little book, The Screwtape Letters, Lewis captures brilliantly the way in which the evil of war can turn people towards faith rather than away from it. In one of the letters from a senior demon to one of his apprentices, Screwtape, he instructs Wormwood about the problem of war and how it can be a really serious problem if you're working against God. "I must warn you not to hope too much from a war. Of course, a war is entertaining. The immediate fear and suffering of the humans is a legitimate and pleasing refreshment for our myriads of toiling workers. Let us therefore think rather how to use than how to enjoy this European war." In fact, it's amazing how many people love violence. "We may hope for a great deal of cruelty and unchastity," it says the demon. "But if we're not careful, we shall see thousands turning in this tribulation to the enemy," which is to God, "while tens of thousands who do not go so far as that will nevertheless have their attention diverted from themselves to the values and causes which they believe to be higher than the self. And consider, too, what undesirable deaths occur in wartime. Men are killed in places where they know that they might be killed, and to which they go, therefore, prepared. They think about death beforehand. How much and better for us," says Wormwood, or Screwtape, rather, to Wormwood, "how much better for us if all humans died in costly nursing homes amid doctors who lie, nurses who lie, friends who lie, as we have trained them, promising life to the dying, encouraging the belief that sickness excuses every indulgence, and even, if our worker knew their job, withholding all suggestion of a priest, lest it should betray to the sick man his true condition. And how disastrous for us is the continual remembrance of death which war enforces. One of our best weapons, contented worldliness, is rendered useless. In wartime time, not even a human can believe that he's going to live forever." Now that's a remarkable piece of writing. Lewis captures here what we surely all know by now, that is, the experience of violence does not naturally drive us to atheism. It, in fact, can rattle our secular and prosaic conventions. As to terrorism, the best place to look for a really deep analysis is, of course, to Russia. That's why we Russians, we Irish, love the Russians. They like vodka and are miserable. Russia, in fact, is the home of modern terrorism, where Fyodor Dostoevsky and Alexander Solzhenitsyn have provided a searing analysis of its nooks and crannies. Dostoevsky's novel Demons is an extraordinary psychological and spiritual account of the mindset of terrorism as it developed in 19th century Russia. It is no surprise that contemporary students in the social sciences have turned, in fact, to that novel for insight. Charles Taylor, the distinguished Canadian philosopher, Roman Catholic, describes the novel Demons in this way. "It is one of the great documents of modern times because it lays bare the ways in which an ideology of universal love and freedom can mask burning hatred directed outward onto an unregenerate world and generating destruction and despotism. This leads young people to political extremes, to a strong ideology of polarization, in which one recovers a sense of direction as well as a sense of purity, lining up in implacable opposition to the forces of darkness. The more implacable, even violent, the opposition, the more the polarity is represented as absolute, and the greater the sense of separation from evil and its purity. Now, the challenge of terrorism is, in the end, one element of the larger challenge of evil in the world. And everything hinges here on how we spell out the descriptions that we deploy. Notice here that both Lewis and Dostoevsky reach for the language of the demonic in an effort to take seriously the full depths of what is at stake. We are reminded of the evil that readily cropped up in World War II, when folk felt as if the end of the world had come, that all hell had broken loose on the earth. And what they were doing here is drawing on the language of faith. Prosaic description simply was not sufficient. Moreover, it is not as if we are in search of a language that makes us look good and the enemy bad. Experience of evil can bring home some very painful truths about ourselves as both agents and victims of evil. To Winston Churchill, when he realized what the Allied armies were doing to German civilians, was once heard to explain, "My God, have we become beasts?" Alexander Solzhenitsyn's reflections go even further. Quote, he says, "Looking back, I saw that for my whole conscious life, I had not understood either myself or my strivings. What had seemed for so long to be beneficial turned out in actuality to be fatal. And I had been striving to go in the opposite direction to that which was truly necessary for me. But just as the waves of the sea knock the inexperienced swimmer off his feet and keep tossing him back on the shore, so also was I painfully tossed on dry land by the blows of misfortune. And it was only because of this that I was able to travel the path which had always really wanted to follow. It was granted for me to carry away from my prison," this is again Solzhenitsyn, "on my bent back, which nearly broke beneath its load, this essential experience, how the human being becomes evil and how good. In the intoxication of youthful successes, I had felt myself to be infallible, and I was therefore cruel. In the surfeit of power, I was a murderer and an oppressor. In my most evil moments, I was convinced that I was doing good, and I was well supplied with systematic arguments. And it was only when I lay there on the rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of God, of good, rather. Gradually it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through the states, not between classes, not between political leaders either, but right through every human heart and through all the human hearts. This line shifts. Inside us it oscillates with the years, and even with hearts overwhelmed by evil, one small bridgehood of good is retained. And even in the best of all hearts, there remains an uprooted corner of evil." Now, Solzhenitsyn, of course, is a Christian, drawing on the great resources of the Russian tradition in Christianity. Now, what I'm getting at here are two things, really. One is that when things get really bad, we have language to reach for. And it's actually the language of apocalyptic and eschatology. Now, you think that's strange language, isn't it? But when, don't you love country and Western music? Well, nobody loved country and Western music down here. When Willie Nelson and Dolly Parton fall out of love, the skies turn black, and the sun ceases to shine, and the foundations of the earth are shaken. Now, by the way, that would be a whole other lecture on the language of eschatology. And, you know, sometimes you'll say, "It was hell in my marriage last year." You take the language of the end, and you start applying it to here and now. And for students at Perkins this year in their second year in systematics, it's purgatory. Until they get to the end of the semester. And then it's heaven on earth. Now, that's a whole other issue. The whole language of apocalyptic and eschatology is a way of actually capturing the depths of awful things that happen, sometimes very good, sometimes appalling. And the other thing that I'm doing here in drawing particularly on Solzhenitsyn is that when you really come to terms with evil, it's not that you're going to sort of project it out onto everybody else and that's the problem. Eventually what happens, you know, it's deep down inside your own heart. And that is, in fact, an extraordinarily important, a very important discovery. Now, our descriptions of evil will determine how we work out the solutions. If you've got a disease, that's name of it determines the remedy. If we see the world in purely scientific categories, then, of course, to science we will turn. If we see the world primarily in political categories, then that will be the first tendency that we call up. If we see it fundamentally in psychological categories, then we will reach for the phone and a therapist and a psychiatrist. If we think it's an issue of war, we'll turn to the military. If it's all a matter of economics, we will weed out our commitments to either socialism, capitalism, or whatever. But it seems to me that terrorism cuts to a deeper level than any that science can give us. It makes us think about life itself. It makes us think deeply about human agents and about ourselves as a problem. Now, what I want to propose here, and again, I hope you'll go with the subtlety that's ahead, because it could be easy to misunderstand me. I think that we need the language of the demonic to deal with the reality of evil as we find it in terrorism. Lewis and Dostoevsky are exactly right in the direction in which they take us. Here we're moving to the spiritual and the theological, and we're moving away from purely secular and this worldly accounts of what's happening. But what do I mean by the demonic, and how does that notion help? The core idea is this. With the demonic, we are dealing with the inversion of the good. Everything is turned upside down and distorted, so that we are deceived in our perceptions and in our actions. With the demonic, we encounter evil masquerading as good, the ugly presented as if it's beautiful, the corrupt in the appearance of purity, and the demonic disguised as the divine. We are visited by an idealism that turns out to be destruction, a gentleness in private life that becomes thoroughly sadistic, to a freedom that ends up in despotism, and to a love that turns out to be hatred. Truth is found by intimidating honest observers and killing critics. Honor is gained by killing the innocent. Liberty is achieved by multiplying victims. The renewal of Western society is supposed to be brought about by the organs of alienation. The emancipation of women is ushered in by radical subordination to man. God's will is executed by the destruction of the Jews. Lucidity comes by suppressing debate and intimidating scholars. And somehow peace is to be accomplished by bloody massacres. And marriage is made sacred by multiplying temporary wives for soldiers. Justice is planted supposedly by the use of terror, and the highest evil is found by reaching for the highest good. And what is at stake is radical distortion and deception. Now, I am aware that if we think of the demonic at all, we tend to think of cases which, for example, are more robustly known as demon possession. The gospel and the history of the church have a steady set of examples that fit that pattern. Most folk, if they are aware of this material, readily dismiss it as legendary mythology, misdiagnosis of mental illness, and the like. Now, if you want me to lecture on that topic, you'll have to pay me another salary and I'll come down and do it. In fact, it's a very interesting topic. By the way, do you know that Rome has had to open up a two-week seminar on the demonic, on demon possession. The atheist promised us, you know, a land that would be free and reasonable and rational. And what do you get in Europe? You get appalling sensuality among many of our young people. You get football hooliganism. And you get the resurgence of the occult to the point where, in fact, the Vatican will have seminars on this. Now notice, that's not the version of demon, the demonic, that I'm talking about here. That's another issue. It requires some serious ontological and epistemological work, which I would be prepared to do. What I'm interested in here is, if you like, demonic with a small d, not demonic with a big D. And at the heart of this is the inversion of the good. Now let me spell this out in particular way as follows. Consider what's being involved in being what we may call a Top Gun terrorist. Start out by becoming a charismatic figure, maybe hiding somewhere in a cave in an obscure and inaccessible corner of the world. Then convince thousands of literate and illiterate young men and women that you're the builder and maker of true civilization. Surround yourself with an adoring network of brothers who are bound together by the shedding of innocent blood. Train young men and indeed some women to commit suicide by the promise of sensual delights in the world to come. Spend your own personal fortune and additional millions of dollars collected in the form of religious charity in the service of the poor. Become such a spectacular organizer of the deaths of thousands of innocent people in a faraway city that your image and name are an icon of purity across a world of piety and faith. Find agents who will seek out and find the nuclear weapons that you can use to burn additional thousands in an incinerating fire. And while you're at war with a country that you want to use as a basis for training, give permission for your soldiers, to be issued blank marriage certificates signed by religious leaders and encourage them to take wives during the battle so that they will be sexually fulfilled. Turn marriage, at least in the short time, into a license to rape. The recipe for distortion and deception is all straightforward. Let the anti-hero become a hero. Let the pious man step forth as a lethal killer. Offer up sacrifice, death, loyalty, and personal risk in the service of bombs and bullets. Proclaim murder and mayhem as the pathway to liberty and life. Turn noble things upside down and claim to exemplify a life of divine virtue. Here surely is the gold standard of classic demonic activity with a small d. The inversion of the good, distortion, is and self-deception. The problem with so much of the conventional talk about terrorism is that it lacks depth and it looks terrorists from this angle of vision. The standard discourse cannot adequately capture the darkness and paradoxes involved. Here were some of the things that were said after 9/11. 9/11 was a secret plot by President Bush and his capitalist associates in the White House to provide a pretext to invade Iraq to get more oil. 9/11 was the judgment of God on America for permitting promiscuity and homosexuality. America has gotten what was coming to her. The real problem is fundamentalism. I'm just quoting here. Here's another one. Terrorism is the natural result of commitment to moral absolutes in the quest for certainty. Or another one. Terrorism is all a matter of propaganda of the deed. Or it's a blowback against globalization and American imperialism. It's a clash of civilizations. There's a catalog of the standard non-theistic versions of what happened on 9/11. The objection to all these kinds of explanations is not simply that they're superficial and contradictory. The problem is that this kind of talk is so reductive. It's very clear, we know, that factors like hatred of the West, the presence of American soldiers in the Holy Land, and so on, they are a matter of importance in understanding the Islamist terrorists. However, it does not begin to do justice to the fantasies, the sadism, and the erotic attachment to anti-heroes involved. By the way, I didn't get to talk much about Ireland, and I apologize in part for that, because I want to go straight to Islam. I read the lives of these folk in the north of Ireland in Belfast, and most of them are women eating out of their hands. I mean, men who spent their lives killing innocent people. And they had no difficulty whatsoever lining up. This is on the Protestant side, if I may say so, the so-called loyalist side. No trouble whatsoever on the mattress, as they said. The problem here is that terrorists have inverted the good and become subjects of their own distortions and self-deception. And this is nothing new in the history of the world. We've had a legion of self-deceptions in the modern period. And scientism, where we're all reduced to physics and chemistry. Communism, which sees it all as a matter of economics. Nihilism, mainly out of Germany in the 19th century. Various forms of fascism, and nationalism, and racism, and materialism. What all these have in common is their denial of God and their practice of idolatry. They deny God's good creation. They deny its meaning, filling up the vacuum with fantasies that promise us life but deliver death of the soul and all too often death of the body. They buy into distorted visions of the human condition and deceive themselves into accepting their false promises. Now, in no way here do I want to eliminate human responsibility. This is why this is small d demonic. It's not big d demonic. No, that's another issue. But I think the problem in the end is a very deep problem, and it's a problem that can only be stated in theological categories, in spiritual categories. Secular categories don't cut it. They're not deep enough. And here I end. If the problem is complex and full of paradoxes, we should expect the solution to be no less complex and paradoxical. What do we need? We surely need a divine figure whose healing grace can match the whirlwind of inversion that is central to this kind of fall into evil. We need to find the way and the truth in the life that will stand us upright and enable us to love God and love our neighbors. We need a restoration of the image of God in human agents. We need to be born again through a birth from above and introduced to the moral energy that will take us out of our distortion and our self-deception. We need prevenient, justifying, and sanctifying grace. To put it differently, we are what we eat. We have digested the poison of the serpent. It's time to feast upon the bread of heaven. We have devoured the flesh and drunk the blood of our fellow sisters and brothers. We now need to eat the flesh and drink the blood of the Son of God. It is God alone who can heal us. More precisely, it's not just any God who can save us. It is a God of suffering love who lived and died among us. It was a God who was on Herod's hit list when he massacred the innocents. It is the God who was interrogated by Pilate, the cynical politician preoccupied with questions of security. It is the God who was brutally crucified by Roman soldiers. It is the God who, through suffering, has judged our evil ways for what they are. It is the God who has gone beyond suffering to defeat the horror of death in resurrection. And it is the God who, by His Spirit, can raise us from the dead and take possession of our hearts and minds. It is the God who knits us into His own body in the church and thereby makes available through space and time the treasures of medicine that heal us of our evil days, evil ways. No state or nation or religion or institution or book or academic expert or politician or philosopher or guru can supply what we need at this level. These cannot resolve the paradoxes that haunt us in the knowledge of ourselves brought home by terrorism. Only a new set of paradoxes that match the reality of terrorism can do that. Only a crucified God can deliver us from the demonic. Consider the paradoxes as I finish, captured with pleasing simplicity in the liturgy of the burial of Christ in the Russian Orthodox Church. We see a strange and fearful mystery accomplished today. He whom none may touch is seized. He who loses Adam from the curse is bound. He who tries the hearts of men is unjustly brought to trial. He who closes the abyss is shut in prison. He before whom the hosts of heaven stand with trembling stands before Pilate. The Creator is struck by the hand of his creature. He who comes to judge the living and the dead is condemned to the cross. The conqueror of hell is enclosed in a tomb. O thou who hast endured all things in thy tender love, thou hast saved all men from the curse. O long-suffering Lord, glory to thee. Every age of the West has its own hour of decision and destiny. In the 19th century, we faced the challenges thrown up by Darwin, by Freud, by Nietzsche, and by Marx. In the 20th century, we faced the threat posed by Hitler and Stalin. It was a commonplace of the last generation that whatever the options we would face in the 21st century, they would be entirely secular in nature. We could not have been more wrong. The really big decision is no longer simply between Nietzsche and Darwin and Freud and Marx and Hitler and Stalin. We must also take into account afresh the challenge posed by Muhammad and by Jesus Christ. If we take the challenge of Jesus Christ seriously, then I put it to you, terrorism is not a reason to challenge God. It is an occasion to find God hanging on a cross and to find there the mercy and hope that we all need for ourselves, for our enemies, and for our world. I'm done.
I agree with some of the things you said.
That's fine.
Let's see how to turn this on.
It's on now?
Yeah.
Okay. What I have observed in my life is that within all the major religions, evil exists. There's a seed of evil in it. It's only when those things are tamped down that evil is subdued for a while. The evil that I talk about usually is because of the way the religion came about. It's Genesis. Almost everyone started with basically suffering and war and violence. Eventually, it was us against them. It was saying your enemies were less than human, that they were ungodly. They were not you or us. And so unspeakably horrendous things would happen in the name of religion, and it still does.
Mm-hmm.
When you have religion that is born basically of us against them, and bigotry, considering your opponents lesser than you, allows you to create the situation of murdering, killing, justifying your actions. And so religion, the major religions, born of war and of violence and suffering, they are probably, I still say, the single greatest cause of what I would call terrorism and war and violence. It's also the solution to it. That's the strange thing that I see. There's a part in every major religion that can justify the horrendous acts that are committed today. And when secularism comes in, it has a way of tamping that down, a way of creating a greater tolerance. It's those groups, those minority groups, the Minority Report.
Yes.
That adopt the part of the religion that glorifies killing the non-believer, of recreating heaven on earth. And so you see that, I think, among the Muslims extremists. They take a portion of the Quran which emphasizes that effort to defeat the ungodly, to take back what is theirs, to recreate the caliphate and the wonderful times that the Muslims had. You see it in other religion too, including Christianity, that comes back to the Old Testament as justifications. Just like Judaism, when it justifies the killing of the people that inhabited Canaan. And so I think religion is always at war with itself, particularly with those, let's say, we call them fundamentalists. Those are the ones that have grasped that Minority Report, the genesis of their religion. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that emphasize that. And we have to determine strategies, what strategies, to tamp down the intolerance and take the good, because you could take all the major religions, in three quarters of them, they could overlay and they would be very similar.
Okay. Do you want to pull it together with a question, or you want to leave it there?
Okay. Question is.
No, that's fine.
I wanted to hear more about what is the genesis of ISIS? Oh. How do they pull from, I think, the Minority Report, which is the genesis?
Right.
And what is the strategy? We need to do that, as well as those in our Christian religion, where we have fundamentalists who are willing to kill doctors.
Okay. There's a lot here. And we clearly need a much longer conversation, either at a good pub, and I'll pay for the wine, the Australian wine. But actually, I'm not interested in religion in one respect. I'm interested in God. And I'm interested in the grace of God. And I'm interested in divine action. And I'm interested in a God who fixes my own heart and my own soul and my own life. And so religion, actually, in terms of that concept, is a relatively modern notion and often masks the radical differences that exist across the board, both within religions and between them. And so, in one respect, I would need a much longer conversation to work through what's at stake here. But I want to make... I think some forms of religion are really bad for you. I think they're poisonous. I think they're actually corrupting. And this is deeply true in the history of the Christian tradition. we could go through that. But that's not the whole story. The story of the Christian religion is also the creation of hospitals and the creation of schools. And the Enlightenment, actually, which you refer to as a sort of, we might refer to as a secular world, was the creation of Christians. Enlightenment world was actually created by people like Descartes and Locke and Kant and others, who were fed up with Christians killing each other. Now, I have a 500-page book arguing that case against the standard view within philosophy, which doesn't even want to deal with the issues at that point. So there are two sets of issues here. One is, I think we, you and I are together at the end. We want a kind of, we want an account of the particularities of something like ISIS. And it'll require questions about who are the individual personalities involved. It'll be lucky contingencies in terms of, for example, getting a hold of the American weapons. It will involve theological proposals about Armageddon. An apocalyptic nonsense that they've bought into. It will include their mastery of the internet. There's a whole range of things in there that are very particular to the development of ISIS, which you can, I think, there's very good literature emerging on that. But I think deep down, you and I, we're living on different planets. And this is not not a way of putting you down in any way, shape, or form. Because I think that the issue for me, I couldn't give a tuppenny damn for a lot of religion. That sounds rather strong talk. I can give you a catalogue of the vices that show up in religion. The Irish are religious and it's impossible to make them moral. And moral, the English tend to be moral and it's impossible to make them religious. We all have our own vices and whatnot. So, what I think is at stake at the end of the day, and this is a central piece in my lecture, and we would need a lot longer, to me, the issue is not religion, it's God. And is there a God who's created a good world, and is there a God who's entered into that world in Jesus Christ? Is there a God who can live in our hearts and lives now by the power of the Holy Spirit? I think the answer to all of those is yes. And if that was not real and was not visible in conspicuous sanctity, and wasn't visible in the creation of incredibly important institutions in the world, like Methodist hospitals here in Houston and elsewhere, if that was not visible in those things there, I'm giving my money back. But in the meantime, I'm staying the course. Over here. Oh, sorry, forgive me.
Okay. I attended, my wife is involved with the Lay School of Theology, you know, from Perkins. And I attended a lecture on process theology, and the fellow who was giving, the professor that was giving the lecture, basically, in some of the things you've been talking about, his position was, I may have this name wrong, you'll have to forgive me, Niebuhr from the 1930s and the like. His position, and he had the voice of the president and everything else, was that turn the other cheek. Like you see Jesus and his disciples and some of the early martyrs, works on a one-to-one basis, but it doesn't work with nation states.
Yes.
Now, my specific question, having lost relatives in 9/11 and having been to Israel last year and seen the wall separating Bethlehem, Palestinian territories, which seems to get so many people upset, where I see it as a humble servant of God, as just putting a wall between me and somebody that's coming after and trying to kill me. So my point is, how do you reconcile turn the other cheek with dropping bombs on your enemy?
Yeah, I'm a Niebuhrian too. I'm not a pacifist. And I for me it's a matter of the worst option available to you. It's like Churchill said about democracy, it's the worst form of government except any other. So when terrorists get organized and start killing my neighbors, it's a matter of love, actually, that I stand by my neighbors and help protect them. It's a contested issue. And it's got its own difficulties, but this is fundamentally Niebuhr's position, Reinhold Niebuhr's position, and I share that view.
We have a right to try to protect the Coptic Christians that are being killed.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what's needed there is a proper theology of civic life and of social life and political life, which would be a whole other topic. Now, the interesting thing about the wall, we have walls in Belfast. Dividing so-called Catholics from so-called Protestants. They haven't come down. If you take a tour in Belfast, they take you around it in black taxis. It's a wonderful experience, actually. If the only way you can stop people killing each other is by a wall, put the wall up. I'm a person of ordinary, realistic common sense. I have colleagues who think the walls are appalling. But if you have people who are shooting at you or killing you or coming in the dead of night, which is what it happens, and blowing up your homes and taking pubs out and killing people, put a wall up. And then hope that one day in the providence of God and in a moral awakening, they'll stop doing it. I actually have a very low level of success in civic life. I'm actually relatively happy if we don't kill one another. I do not expect a reconciliation. I do not expect that we will be able to sit down in peace and harmony and work things out. I think the default position, maybe not quite with the origins of religion, I think the default position is conflict. And if you live at a period when there is no conflict and when you have relative peace and security, you get out the mariachi bands and enjoy it. Now, this may sound like sort of deep pessimism, but so it is. But it's a pessimism that I think is grounded in a deep vision of what the human condition is. And at the end of the day, I think if people say no to God and tell God to F off, we're going to take care of things down here. I think what you're going to get is self-destruction and a lot of trouble. And I think it's part of the providence of God to provide actually restraints and constraints on that, which is the position of Nietzsche and Luther and a few others. Now, I'm going to leave. Where's Marty? He's in charge of the microphone.
You mentioned early on that you don't hold up. Your colleagues don't have the same opinion of you about terrorism and how to deal with it, if I'm remembering right, and it was a little unpopular. Could you explain that?
Well, I actually hide some of the things I write. I have a book out on this topic that I hide under the bed. Because my son said to me, Sean said to me, he said, Dad, don't publish that book, they'll come after you. In fact, I say things about Ireland and I'm afraid to go back. I'm half serious. Right. So academic life is also full of conflict. And conflict. So I don't want to be too general. I have colleagues who would agree probably 80% of what I'm saying. But the general disposition is to see terrorism in secular terms. And I think this is a long-standing development in modern theology where theologians lost their nerve in the late 19th century. I have a wider diagnosis of this. And where in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases when it comes to topics like this, they're functional atheists. As I say, the only resources that you'll bring to bear on this are from psychology, sociology, general observations about the world that you make, that anybody could make. And what I'm deeply, one of the reasons why I'm deeply committed Christian and intellectually, a very poor one in terms of being a sinner like everybody else, but one of the reasons why I was drawn to the Christian faith and stayed in the Christian faith is that it takes evil really seriously. And it provides you not only with the language at times which you need in order to cope with the ravages of it, I think it also, in the gospel, takes it with radical seriousness. And by the way, I think the outcome of the gospel, all of the gospels say that the purpose of coming of Jesus was not to die. Now it says he came to die, he said he died, and to give his life as a ransom for many. All of the Gospels say that Jesus came to baptize us in the Holy Spirit. Wow. And what does that mean? that the very same spirit that brought Jesus into the womb of Mary, and the very same spirit that raised him from the dead, is available to transform human existence. And that's why I'm a Methodist. Because Methodism is about the power of God at work in human lives to transform them. And that's the focus of the faith in its response to evil. So we'll go from there. Over here.
Did you call on me?
I did.
I'm not in charge.
Let me see a moment about... Is this okay? I'm disturbed by an awful lot. It seems to me that the question remains, if we had someone in the White House who lived within the same universe of discourse and symbol system and embrace of Christianity that you have described, that he would not be any better equipped to deal wisely with the instrumentalities at his hand, at his disposal, than he might be if he were a master of several other universes of discourse and symbol systems. I'm also disturbed by how readily you make peace with the impossibility of peace, and I'm disturbed by your, well, it seems peculiar to speak of a pessimistic cavalier, but you seem to have a cavalier acceptance of guns and knives and minor weapons without realizing that in the world today we're talking about weapons that are not minor, that can destroy the human race almost entirely, that can ruin possibly forever the hope that the environment can support human life. You've talked about killing innocent civilians, and of course that is a part of the just war theory and the idea of discrimination in the selection of targets. But modern weapons do not discriminate in the selection of targets. The confining targets to combatants only died with the blanket bombing of German cities in World War II, refusing to target civilians, died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Drones seem consistently to find success at killing a target, a single person, while there are collateral damages, meaning the death of innocent civilians and human beings. You seem to believe that the conversation we need within our society should include only one universe of discourse and one symbol system, which you have eloquently and passionately and with great poetic power described to us. I think otherwise my concerns are simple.
Well, you know, I'm tempted to plead guilty.
Okay. I accept that.
But only tempted. You're just dead wrong that I only occupy one universe of discourse. You don't know me. You don't know my views on Hiroshima. You don't know my views on just war. They're treated elsewhere in this area. You're simply assuming that you know them. And as to what should be done in the White House, I leave that to the White House. What matters to me is that Christians have a range of options that they think through, and that lay people who become elected to presidencies actually have access to a whole range of discussion about this. So in a way, I'm just going to leave it the way it is. because I think that there's a, I think you're assuming a whole network of proposals about me and about what I'm saying that do not apply. And I think to take them on one at a time would not really be particularly fruitful. I think you and I could sit down and walk through the issues of what happened in the Second World War. And I think we could walk through what happened at Hiroshima. Of course, this is a problem for those who are committed. I don't think that the just war tradition works.
No longer.
Well, we may reach agreement on that. And therefore, the issue becomes not whether you are committed to a just war. I doubt if there is such a thing, given what you said. But the issue is, what are your alternatives? And your alternatives will include both what you said about weapons, and it will include a full range of discussion of the Christian options. And I think, therefore, maybe we would find a way to go forward with together on many of these issues. But one of the nice things about coming from Ireland, if I may dare appeal to that one more time, is that I've had to survive in a world where broadly speaking, I've been unorthodox. I'm unorthodox in the field of philosophy, which is my primary field of training, because I'm a very robust Christian. And I'm unorthodox in the field of contemporary theology, because I have a very robust vision of the Christian tradition. So, in a way, I think you've accurately captured me. And in the end, I don't know whether it's your problem or my problem. And for both of us, we're just going to have to deal with it and suck it up as best we can. One more.
Test.
By the way, there's somebody at the back as well, I think we should think about.
You made mention yesterday and today that there are, what would I call them, moderate voices in Islam. Let me tell you the problem I've got. I understand what taqiyya is. It's okay for a Muslim to lie to a non-Muslim if he's got the best interest of Islam at heart. How do I believe any of the men that you referred to?
Get a life. And take them seriously. It's going to do no good whatsoever if we don't take these people at their word when they say that they're going to provide a radical reform version of Islam. And so I think part of the job of Christians in this situation is that actually we need to support every effort that's made to defang the more poisonous elements that show up in religious traditions. And that will involve dealing with texts like that there. And it simply, I mean, you and I are just on a different page here at this point. And the fact of the matter is, religions don't stand still. They reform in various directions. Some of them go back into various rabid forms of orthodoxy that are not very pleasant. Others go into forms of revision that actually are extraordinarily important. And that doesn't stop. And all I would want to say at this stage is that the literature is there, and I think you're going to have a hard time saying that these people don't mean what they say. And part of what they're up against is what you're talking about, namely, there are going to be those within Islam who are going to say you're a traitor and you betray us and you're not a true Muslim. But of course, that's what they said to Protestants when we emerged. I will not tell you what they thought Methodists were when we came on the show. Some of them thought we were having orgies at our Lord's Supper. And I could give you a long list of diatribe against early Methodism, which was in fact false. So I think we just differ here. You're a pessimist, and my glass is three quarters full. And I'm willing to go with those who are ready to make these changes. Back at the back there. And this is the last one, I suspect.
Hello, I got stage fright for a second. All right, so mine's a bit of an anecdote. I've kind of compressed it over the time that I've had. I started off my journey to Christ in a philosophy class.
Good.
And the philosophical argument that brought me to Christ and to pursuance was It was a statement. I couldn't tell you the name, never good with names with people I've never met. But the argument was that if there's a God and God is only good, why is there evil in the world? And I'm sure you probably know which one I'm talking about now, is that it states that God allows for the minimum amount of evil to occur for the maximum amount of good to occur. And as we all know, for there to be good, there must be evil. And then again, the Bible tells us that sin was always in the world as the world was created, but man was unaware of it. And through the knowledge given by eating the fruit of good and evil, or the knowledge of good and evil, then man became like God, knowing these things that man did not know. I believe in an omnipotent, omnipresent, all-powerful God who is pulling the strings, working behind the scenes, and doing all that is. And I understand that a lot of what Peter says is that by knowing this, am I to go out and act in sin? And, you know, Peter says, by no means. Because just because I know this doesn't give me my free pass. So I've heard a lot tossed around here today. I've heard a lot of systematic reasoning as to address this problem. And I've heard a lot of political reasoning and war effort. But my question to you, and I have my own opinion, and I'll leave here with my opinion.
Sure.
But I'm interested in yours. And yeah. As Christians, yeah. What are we to do in this day in regards to that, in regards to the issue that we've discussed here?
Well, the first thing we've got to do is understand it. And that's, you know, and I've trained as a philosopher in the analytic tradition. And, you know, there are obvious options you've got if you work on the problem of evil from the way in which you've done. And I do not see any effort. I cannot see any utilitarian attempt on God permitting evil in order to bring greater good at certain... I don't think that's going to work. I think that if I was an atheist, I would nail you every time with the existence of horrendous evil, with busloads of children who are seriously handicapped. I would take you to Auschwitz and say, tell me how you can justify that in terms of some greater good. I'm totally with Job at this stage. The only way to deal with certain kinds of evil is to amend. And Job's problem was not that problem. The problem was, how can I stay the course if, in fact, I'm confronted with this kind of evil or this kind of suffering? The reason why I stay the course is because I think there are other things that I know about God that are not simply a matter of argument. They're a matter of divine revelation. And if I did not believe in a crucified God, I would not be a Christian, for better or worse. So for me, the issue is the experience of those who have come to know and love God and have experienced the power of God in their lives, and some of them directly experienced the reality of God in a way that I've not. I take their testimony really seriously. I think that's more than enough to keep me on board. Now, briefly on the Genesis 3 material, which you referred to about all those trees and knowledge of good and evil and so on, and that, in fact, is brilliant Jewish propaganda. Written at a period when their children were being tempted to buy into all sorts of idolatrous nonsense. And it was a Jewish way to say that what's really gone wrong is we started entertaining half-truths about God. Maybe God's a cosmic spoil sport. Did he really say that? And you know... You can't trust that God. He's a bit like a dentist who's going to take out your teeth without any anesthetic. And it's an extraordinary spiritual and psychological sort of etiological account of how things go wrong in the heart of every human soul who thinks deeply about these matters. And then the solution, actually, is from Genesis 12 onwards. And I'll just finish this way. In this respect, I think if we didn't have the Jewish background, we'd be up a creek. And God comes along and says, Abraham, you know what you can get? You know what I'm going to give you? Babies and real estate. I'm a Jew. I want babies and grandbabies, and I want real estate. And I want to know if God's really committed to my welfare. And the history of the Jewish experience of God is that God can be trusted. And that's partly what was going on in the story of Abraham, when in fact he was tempted not to trust God. And the full expression of the truth about God, initially given in Israel, is brought to its fullest expression in the coming of Christ. And if anybody has any queries about the goodness of God and the power of God in the face of all of the evil that we encounter, then that's where I go. It was Christ that brought me to God, and it's Christ that keeps me with God. And it's not that we've got specific answers as to what to do in the White House. I'll get my friend and I, and we'll have a seminar on that. Or what are we going to do with all the bad religion in the world that my friend up here is worried about? Or what we'll do with stupid Christians who want to sort of provide ridiculously simplistic and unconvincing answers to difficult problems. At the end of the day, for me, the deep and real issue is, will I come and know and love God the way that my Lord knew and loved God? And I think the only way that that can happen ultimately is if the same Spirit that brought Jesus into the world, and the same Spirit that healed the sick, and the same Spirit that raised him from the dead, is alive and well in our hearts and alive and well in the church. And I'm convinced that that's absolutely true. And so long as that is true, I'm not giving my money back. I'm not going to become an agnostic Jew. I'll argue with those people who disagree with me. And then we'll go to a pub afterwards, and I'll drink lemonade. And they can have good Australian wine. But only provided they pay for it.